Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape, and this week we are getting arty. Science and art have often been seen as polar opposites, and people often end up focusing on just one of these disciplines. But are they really that different? And how can we benefit from bringing the two together? Joining us to share her experiences of the art sci world is Rachel Bedder, a researcher working in cognitive neuroscience, and also the science curator of AXNS, which stands for Art Times Neuroscience. Good morning, Rachel.
Morning, Matilda. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for coming. Now, just to set us off, please could you give a brief summary of what exactly is AXNS?
Sure. So AXNS Collective, we're a curatorial group of graduates from the arts and sciences, and we work together to create events that bring those disciplines together in engaging and thought-provoking ways. So that can be through commissioning artwork, running panels, workshops, and exhibitions that engage people who work in those disciplines, but also people who might not belong to either, in the idea that you can cross-pollinate these ideas in really interesting ways, and they have a lot to learn from each other. So we're made up mainly of art historians, designers, neuroscientists, all with full-time jobs or full-time studenting. And yes, so we all have a big passion for doing this as well.
Yeah, super cool. And we'll be talking more about specifically some of the stuff you've been doing with that throughout the show. Coming up, we're also going to be making some colour volcanoes, recreating the artist palette right there. So this is going to be using a scientific reaction to make some beautiful colours. All you need is a cupcake-type baking tray, one with a, like, little wells in it, some vinegar, bicarbonate of soda, and as many different food colours as you want. We also want to hear from you. So this week, we are asking, what has been your experience of art versus science? Do you feel they're fundamentally different? Have you always been good at one and not good at the other? Or do you think they're more similar than they seem? You can tweet us at Soho Radio. Please do and share your thoughts. Now, Rachel, this is your mixtape. You've chosen all the songs today. So can you tell me, what are we starting with?
So we're going to start with Bruce Springsteen, Dancing in the Dark. Bruce Springsteen is one of my all-time favourite artists. And this is a nice upbeat one you might listen to on a Saturday morning and things.
I come home in the morning, I go to bed feeling the same way.
Albert Einstein once said, "All religions, arts and sciences are branches of the same tree. All these aspirations are directed towards ennobling man's life, lifting it from the sphere of mere physical existence and leading the individual towards freedom."
Beautiful. Now, Rachel, are you arty or sciencey? What would you say is your background?
It completely depends which group I'm with. When I'm with my science friends, I tend to be the arty one, and vice versa as well. So my degree was in art and psychology.
You actually were able to do a joint art and psychology degree.
I was the only person doing it in that year. So, but I think it's become a lot more popular since then. Yeah, but they were taught completely separately. So you had your art practice and then also your psychology lectures. But I did have some opportunity to put them together in my final year project, which looked at visual perception. So I started it with the idea that I wanted to do art therapy, but going through the degree, I sort of loved them both very separately as disciplines as well. And it's kind of almost an indecisiveness that's plagued my whole academic career, and that you kind of want to do everything. And it's hard to, you know, commit to something to a certain extent. But I found a lot that, although I was learning them separately, there was a lot of cross-pollination. Yeah, so I found that when I was describing my art practice to people, I talk about it in terms of variables and methods and hypotheses.
Really?
Yeah, and it's And it's interesting to sort of think about painting within that language and as a practice.
Yeah. Can you give an example? What would be like a variable in your art?
So my painting was largely oil painting. And then I think about manipulating the brushstroke in a particular way. And as all artists think about things like that, how you're changing your brushstrokes. But I would very consciously think about it as like, what variable is this and how will this change?
And
this
almost
outcome?
Making it in an experiment or whatever.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, art is very experimental. You can very happily move the language from science to art and vice versa. So yeah, I always thought about it like that.
That's so, I'm kind of really jealous. I always wanted to do like a joint biology and English degree. And
that would have been great.
You've managed to do it. I didn't think it existed.
You could have come out with some very interesting science fiction from that kind of degree.
Yeah, exactly.
Give John Wyndham a run for his money.
There is a whole thing actually about how in some ways science fiction writers, there's an argument that they even inspire kind of some of the research that we then do into.
Well, I think it's less of an argument, almost absolute fact. I think there are some, I'm scouring my brain, I can't think of one immediately right now, but there's definitely examples of things in science fiction that have gone on to become reality.
Yeah.
Gosh, I'm trying to think of some now, but I know I'll pick one and it'll be the complete opposite.
Oh, it's fine. We can come back to it. I can't think of one at the moment either.
Yeah.
I've just got Brave New World in my head. But so how did you first discover AXNS and get involved in it?
So I discovered AXNS, I think, in the penultimate year of my degree, when I just saw something online about this exhibition Affecting Perception in Oxford.
And of course, that was really relevant to your final project, wasn't
it? Yes. So it was looking at, they were looking at artists with neurological disorders and people who had changes in their visual perception. Some people who were artists initially and had this change, or some people who were motivated to produce art because of these changes. And I remember going and seeing this exhibition and just thinking, oh gosh, you can put these two things together. I haven't just been wasting 3 years of my life. And they had this fantastic picture as soon as you went in by this artist called John Adams, who has Asperger's syndrome. And he comes from a geology background, but creates these fantastic computer-generated images from sort of scientific rules. There are some rules that he's taken from science and some from his own ideas, and creates these beautiful kind of topographical rock formation type images. And they had this gorgeous one initially when you came in, which I think is called 228. That was a big moment for me of things kind of almost clicking.
And then I
found out about this collective and sort of harassed them on social media till they let me join.
That's brilliant. And we're going to hear more of what you've actually been doing with them in the next section. But we need to have your second song choice. So what have you gone with next?
So for my second song, I was thinking about things I used to listen to at university. And before I went to uni, my dad gave me his record player and all his records. So I used to listen to Fleetwood Mac Rumours on repeat over and over again. So I picked one of my favourite ones from that, which is Go Your Own Way.
If I could, baby, I'd give you my world. Open up, everything's waiting for you. You can go your own way. Go your own way. You can call it another lonely day. You can go your own way.
Cezanne was myopic, which means short-sighted, as were several other impressionists. Monet, Pissarro, Degas and Renoir all struggled with impaired vision, and in some cases may have exploited it.
Yeah, I remember doing art history and learning about Monet and how he saw colours differently, and that's why they think all his watercolours all have this kind of really unique and uniform kind of look, and they're all very sort of pastel-y. And it is crazy thinking about that, how art is about kind of conveying your perception of something to the rest of the world. And actually, if you are seeing things differently, that you're getting a really unique version of the world. And that's really cool.
Absolutely. And the Impressionists were really interesting for that, and the way that they were the first people to try and communicate light in this way that wasn't just representative. It's very much about feeling the material and looking at how it's all put together.
Yeah, rather than just trying to create like a kind of photo reality version of something. So I'm quite interested in why do you think we have this kind of divide this belief that art and science are so different?
So we have it sort of at all levels, don't we? Education levels, cultural level, we'll separate those things. And a lot of, I think, how people think about it themselves comes from this left brain, right brain myth, which is this quite pervasive idea that half of our brain, the right side, is very creative and spontaneous, and that makes you more artistic. And the left side is more logical and detail orientated and analytical.
Yeah, I'm sure I've done like a BuzzFeed quiz on this. Like,
yes, there's millions. And there's absolutely no evidence to suggest you would have a stronger sort of functional connectivity in either side of your brain that would result in these different skill sets. So it's not only wrong, I think it's quite a dangerous myth. So we think in terms of education, this idea that teaching children that they should either be pushed towards the sciences or the arts, and you are one or the other because of some sort of hardwiring in your brain, which is, you know, absolutely not how the brain works, especially at that age. It's highly plastic.
Yeah. Brains are so plastic. Yeah.
So, and it's just, I just think, quite damaging to suggest that if you want to pursue the sciences, you're not creative, and you don't have these ideas where you can leap from one fact to another. And I always felt like my science education at school, especially when you were doing experiments, you weren't experimenting. You came out with a particular outcome, and I understand why, of course, because it could be quite dangerous to give children all these chemicals and be like, ah, just be creative. But I think it's very important that we teach children that these art and sciences aren't opposite, and you can create a really interesting knowledge base for yourself by not committing yourself to one too early, or thinking you can't do the other.
Because so many people, they might have a bad experience or a teacher they don't like, and then they'll just be like, I'm not good at science. And once you've decided that in your head, you feel like
it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, your attitude towards it, then you're not so excited about it. And and then if you find it hard, you're like, oh no, it's because of me, not because the subject's hard, it's because I'm bad at it.
Yeah, exactly. A kind of blame the brain kind of idea.
Yeah. And I completely agree with your point. Like at school, I suppose, a lot of the experiments you do, they're more demonstrations. It's like, mm-hmm. we're going to recreate something that someone else has already done, and we know the result we're supposed to get. And so that's like, oh, I'm following some steps, and I either get the outcome expected or not.
Sure.
And that's not a real experiment, because you're not actually genuinely asking a question and really looking at the data to see. You're just looking at it to see if you did the experiment correctly.
And you can get the marks in your GCSEs. So I don't know what I thought scientists at universities were doing when I was younger, but I think I had this idea that all the science had been done and they were just checking it, you know.
Over and over again,
like, yep, the science is still all right, we're still good. And I had this no idea from a young age that, you know, science was still about discovering new things and creating new ways of understanding and looking at things.
I'm always in awe of anyone who does like theoretical physics, because I think to be able to think of those incredible theories that are so out of the box, like, you know, the idea that of multiple universes and our universe being in a bubble, or the idea that time doesn't have a beginning or an end, like, that is mental. And you need to have such a creative mindset to be able to even conceive of that.
Of course, yeah.
And think of it as a possibility. And I think there's a lot of elements of doing scientific research that, you know, it's involving a lot of problem solving, and you do need creative approaches to that.
Absolutely. There's a neuroscientist we've worked with before, Dr. Caroline DiBernardi-Luft, who's at Queen Mary University, and she talks about how creativity is about being both adequate and novel, and you have to have both of those things to be creative.
What does she mean by adequate?
So you have to come up with a solution that's good enough for the problem, when you think about it in terms of problem solving, but it also has to be creative and novel and interesting. So that's the novelty, is the creative side, and then the adequate side is that it's good enough for its use.
Yeah.
So you need both those things to have a creative outcome, which when she first told me, I thought, God, it sounded exhausting to have to be adequate and novel.
Yeah.
It's like, I could do one of those maybe, but both
reaching
at the same
for the
time.
Stars. So you were telling us before about some really interesting projects that are combining art and science in different ways. I think Google's Deep Dream, you mentioned.
Oh yeah, Google's Deep
Dream. Tell us more about that.
Fantastic. So
Deep Dream is pretty great, just with the title.
I know, it's great. It's a nice opposition to Google's Deep Mind as well. But so Deep Dream is a machine learning feed-forward artificial neural network. So what it does is it takes the, you know, absolute millions of images that are on the internet, feeds them into this algorithm, and the tags that are on the image, so dog, tree, person, for example. So it starts to learn from these words what's in the images, and then it updates them. So it puts that image in, it takes another one and makes this highly tuned algorithm which can identify aspects of pictures, and you can use this in this really interesting way to separate content and style in images. And so you can, they have this, you can do it on their Deep Dream website, is you can put images in and it will identify the parts and then create these very trippy, psychedelic, almost Illuminati-esque images that have these swirls and what looks like these eyes in the background, all these shapes. And what's really interesting about it is it's very much based on models of the organization of the visual cortex in animals. So that's what makes it a artificial neural network, is it's very much using the rules of how we see and how we perceive the world through our eyes and in our brains. And it's very similar actually to natural language processing, where we know, so I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but speech is one continuous sound. There's no gaps between words.
Really?
Yeah, you don't say the, some, have a gap next word. It's one long noise.
Yeah,
it's
actually that
weird.
Does make sense. Sometimes when I'm editing this show and you just like find words running into each other and you're like, where is that one finished and the other one begun?
So you think about how on earth do, you know, children make sense of this? It's just one continuous noise. And we work it out by there's particular sounds that occur at the beginning of words a lot, and you sort of assign weights to those in your head, and then you can start parcelating the words.
It's like finding outlines within the noise.
Yes, exactly. And that's very simple. Similar to what these, I think they're called convolutional neural networks, or I discovered the other day they're actually called perceptrons, which I think is a fantastic name. I know, Rise
Sounds
of the
like
Perceptrons.
It should be in a Transformer film.
Exactly. So it's really interesting to see these rules that come into psychology and neuroscience, and you can start using them artificially as well, in this kind of biomimicry sense. I think they're really interesting. But it also brings up the question of, are we creating art when we make these new images? Are they art, or are they just kind of cool concepts and funky looking pictures? So it'll be interesting to see how artists start working with that and take it to the next step.
Because there's quite a lot of work around machines. Can machines create art? Can they come up with like a novel piece of music or a novel painting when you've coded them?
Yeah.
And like, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this, because I think some people argue that you have to have that kind of human emotion and human intent behind something for it to be a piece of art. But then other people would argue if it's, you know, aesthetically interesting and it makes you think and people react to it in different ways, which are all the things that a piece of art does, then why can't a machine create a piece of art?
Okay, so I'm a very much a card-carrying reductionist, so I would argue that absolutely, computers at some point will be able to make these emotive pieces, and they will be on some level as interesting, or if you want to put the term, as good as human made. But what the important thing about art is shaped by the context, by the world we live in, by our social political landscape, and these sort of things aren't going to be taken into account by an algorithm or a computer.
Or if they are, it doesn't feel kind of like a response. It feels like you were told to take it into account.
So I think that's one of the things that's always going to separate human-driven art. Human-driven art is a horrible way to put it. And machine-driven art, to make that distinction, that I think is probably a false dichotomy. Probably all dichotomies are false dichotomies. But yeah, so I think that's something that will always separate it.
Mm. I think, though, I completely agree in the way that when you look at a piece of art, and I find it really interesting to understand the kind of thought process that led the artist to that final piece. And I don't think you'd get the same thing with a machine. But there are quite a lot of pieces of art that I think if I didn't know if it was by a machine or a human, I wouldn't be able to tell. And that it's interesting that then my perception of who created it changes how I feel about that piece.
Of course.
Yeah. And one of the other things that I think you were saying you'd created recently was fractured visions.
Fractured visions, yes. So that was a collaboration AXNS set up between a psychologist at King's College, Dominic Fitch, and an augmented reality artist, Tomiko Thiel. And we set them to work together on a project looking at palinopsia. Palinopsia is a visual perception disorder where you see sort of textures from one object merging into another. You might see parts of an object repeated in your visual space. It's quite a rare disorder that that Dominic works with some patients who have it. So we set him with this artist who looked at making so augmented reality is you might be more used to it in terms of thinking about advertising, but it's when you hold your phone camera up to something and then you see something on the camera image on the screen, so sort of projected into the space on the, that's a terrible explanation of it.
Like on your, if you held up your camera, the image that you see on the camera has something added to it.
Yes,
from what is actually
something
there.
Augmented. That's it. Yeah. So we, she worked on using that technology to, there's a couple of places on the King's College campus where you can now hold your phone up, to the shard through this augmented reality app, and you'll see what it feels like to have palinopsia with these textures moving from the shard onto the buildings below.
Oh.
So it's a really interesting art piece. But what was really, really interesting for us was the collaborative process between Tomiko and Dominic, where she would have meetings with him and she would ask him lots and lots of questions about, oh, what happens if the patient does this, or they move this way in space, or they move this way in space and that way in time, what would happen? And a lot of the questions he wasn't completely sure, because she was kind of probing
it from
this
such a different angle.
In such a different way. So I think he found it a really interesting experience for that. And we had a lot of conversations about how, so there's a level of when you're using science in arts, you want to be accurate, but you also don't want to just be illustrating it, because that's not particularly interesting. So finding that middle ground between using the science correctly and accurately, but in also a way that asks different questions than just simply illustrating the visual perception disorder.
That's really important, I think. Yeah, that's a really important point. Wow, we have been talking for ages.
Sorry.
No, your fault.
I can bang on about this forever.
Oh, sorry. God, I know. I was getting so sidetracked. I loved it. I could talk about this all day, but we need to fit in all of your songs. So song three, please tell us about it.
What's song three? What do we have?
Churches, science and vision.
Churches. So there's an obvious reason why this one is here, science and vision. I was just thinking about songs I like, and Churches is a band I really, really enjoy listening to. And this is just a fun song that has science and art in.
And we'll be doing our experiment after this song, so stay tuned for that.
A study by the Department for Education in 2013 reported that 27% of schools had cut subjects in the arts.
It is very scary what they're doing with the school system, isn't it? So much focus on, it is really important, maths and English and the sciences, but it is really such a shame that we don't have a greater focus, I think, on the creative subjects.
Absolutely, and like I said before, they go together so well that, you know, you get a good rounded education when you have your music, your arts, and with your sciences and your maths.
Yeah, bring it all together. Anyway, so something fun that we all love to do at school was an experiment. And we have one for you this morning. Our nice tenuous link is that we are recreating the artist's palette. So you should have, if you're taking part at home, a baking tray like you would put cupcakes in. That's your palette. And we are going to be... you also need your vinegar, your bicarb of soda, and your food colorings. Now Rachel is going to do this for us, and
I'm going to try. I'm not yeah, baking friendly, so I'm a bit scared of the baking tray.
It's producer Lou's mastermind, so I'm going to let her tell us how. Take it away, Lou.
Hey guys, just want to do a quick introduction, just to let you know that I also studied art and psychology, and I thought it'd be a great idea for us to combine art and science today by bringing the palette to life. So Rachel, if you could take over, and if you could start by adding some vinegar into the baking tray.
I'll give it a go.
Catherine and Rachel is now pouring the vinegar into each of the little cupcake bits in her baking tray. Ooh. Yep. Very nice. We pre-filled some of them during the song, so don't worry. It won't take quite as long as it might do for you at home. And Lou, what's the next thing now that all the vinegar's in?
Once all the vinegar's in, if you could please start adding in the primary colours into each of the cake trays, just like you would with your paint palette.
Sure. So all four of them.
So we have got four colours here today. We've got some red, green, blue and yellow. So that's primary colours and primary light colours, because in light, the primary colours are red, green and blue. And in paint, the primary colours are yellow, red and blue. So
I wish I could tell you why that was.
What a combo.
Indeed. Rachel's doing some lovely splayed out different ones. So we've got four yellows at the moment. It's going to look like a cool, funky polka dot pattern.
Hold on, these are pretty stiff.
Oh no, we didn't pre-prep the colours. Negative art points to us. Looks like science is winning at the moment, guys.
Okay. And blue is up next.
It's like we're doing a sports commentary. We're combining sports science and art. What a crazy day.
This feels very blue-peter.
And then some red. Once all the colours are in, what are we going to be doing next, Lou?
We're going to be adding a tiny bit of bicarbonate of soda, and we're going to watch the magic happen.
And is that literally, we're just going to sprinkle it into each of the wells, or how much? Like a teaspoon? Just a pinch?
Somewhere in between a pinch and a teaspoon. Just a little sprinkle.
Okay. Are you ready, Rachel?
Oh, my temptation is to just throw loads in.
Rachel's not mic'd up at the moment, so she just said her temptation was to chuck all of it in. If you're listening, Adrian, do not worry, we will not be doing that. Sorry, there will be no vinegar on the studio floor, I promise. We're gonna keep it nice and tidy.
Cool. So I'll try one.
All right, 3, 2, 1, and our colour volcanoes are go. Yeah, sprinkle it in all of them. Go.
Woohoo! Go crazy.
Beautiful.
Don't say go crazy, because I will.
And they're frothing away. So the reaction that's happening, this is a classic reaction that you can have so much fun with. It's a neutralization reaction. The vinegar is a bit acidic. The bicarbonate of soda is alkali. And when the two mix together, you get this neutralization reaction where they give off a lot of carbon dioxide and water. And the carbon dioxide is what's making that frothy bubbling effect happening, and that is the kind of volcano, the colour volcano rising up in our trays.
And they smell great.
It smells great if you like vinegar. It smells like a fish and chip shop. It does actually look really beautiful. And you can imagine if you wanted to get if you have a little bit more, then they start bubbling over and mixing together, and by the end they're going to look beautiful. So thank you very much for that one, Lou. That was fantastic. Rachel, let's get you back on the microphone. How are you feeling?
They were fun. That's my kind of baking, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Vinegar cupcakes for all. What is going to be our fourth piece of music?
So for our fourth song, I tried to think about something about carving your own pathway and choosing your own things you're interested in, irrespective of what everyone around you is doing. So I chose Mama Cass, Make Your Own Kind of Music, which I think a lot of people recognise from Lost.
One song worth singing, they may try and sell you, 'cause it hangs them up to see someone like you. But you've gotta make your own kind of music, sing your own special song, make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along.
Art has a double face of expression and illusion. Just like science has a double face, the reality of error and the phantom of truth. And that was a quote by René de Mal.
Poet, surrealist poet, from his one, The Lie of the Truth.
I can very much empathise with the reality of error.
Oh God, I know. Yeah, it is tough, like doing proper research.
Yes.
20, like you can spend like 2 weeks on one experiment and it could all go wrong.
Oh, 2 weeks for months, I suppose.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about like your role as the science curator of AXNS and what that involves.
So we all try and sort of work together on most things, but I suppose in the science curatorial role, I would think a bit more about making sure the science is well represented in terms of that it's accessible. So it's not at a level that you need a lot of prior knowledge to understand. And in addition to that, that the science or the scientists are understanding of the artist and what the artist's needs would be, and aren't just looking at art as a tool for science to use, because they have to have a reciprocal respectful relationship.
It's kind of like what you were saying earlier. It shouldn't just be illustrative. It should be asking its own questions and developing its own stuff.
Sometimes when you're not part of a field, you tend to see that field as very homogenous. So people who haven't had much experience with art will often think artists can kind of do all of the mediums and all of the practice. People have probably had the experience of someone go, oh, you're arty, can you do this for me? And it's and in the same
build
way with science,
and then like create a painting and film it,
something like that. Yeah, or people will be like, oh, you can do the photography for this because you're arty. It's like, well, I'm a painter, so you know, I can't. And in the same way with the science, sometimes people view science as very homogenous, and just see it as all as white-coated people working in labs, or even within individual fields. Neuroscience, for example, you can be a neuroscientist in visual perception or the sensory motor system, and all these different things have their own rules and their own demands. So when you bring those two disciplines together, it's very much making sure that there is a respect and understanding, and that willingness to learn about the assumptions the disciplines make, and also question them and your own assumptions as well.
And how do you go about deciding on like what are going to be your next kind of projects or exhibitions?
So like I said before, we all have our own jobs or full-time studies, so we're all really passionate about different areas. So sometimes it can be the problem that we want to do so many things and we're like, oh, we're interested in this and this as well. So we have a very democratic structure, and we'll talk over what we're all interested in at the moment, what connections we have. But what we're very much excited about looking at next is, rather than continuing on this sort of working on panels and workshops, is generating research through what we do ourselves. So doing more collaboration between artists and scientists and making new things come out of that. So we're quite interested at the moment in this possible project we might do on phantom pain,
Cool.
which is like phantom limbs, but with phantom pain. So this idea that people have pains in their limbs, but they won't be from any particular source, and they often describe them in these really interesting metaphorical ways, like barbed wire and sort of the materials that are causing the pain that obviously aren't there. And we're quite interested in having an artist look at that. So that's potentially our next project.
I've definitely heard about that in the medical community, how people from some countries or some different cultures will talk about pain in different ways, and often complain of like total pain all over their bodies, which doesn't have, like you say, like a medical source, but it's often more psychological, and it's just how they're expressing that psychological situation.
Yeah, so pain is very interesting compared to other touch sensations. So pain is almost, and I'm speaking slightly out of my comfort zone here, so I hope I get the science right. Pain is mostly coded in the brain, whereas things like heat and pressure are largely coded in the neurons in the skin, the ganglion cells, and then sent up to the brain and understood. But pain is much more a neurological
brain
thing. Yeah,
the brain's interpretation.
Which I suppose is probably why you get phantom pain and not phantom heat. possibly, you probably could get that as well, but I think that's why it tends to be weighed towards the pain, which is a really interesting thing.
Definitely. And what have you got coming up apart from the phantom pain?
So we're quite interested in data at the moment, so that's always part of our conversations, is looking at what kind of art can come out of that.
Big data is like a huge kind of challenge for the scientific community at the moment. Like a lot of the kind of space research or even medical research, all just generating huge numbers.
Yeah, so you've got big data and you've also got open data as well, the big open data movement, which is becoming a more and more interesting thing in the artistic community, that you have these giant data sets, which obviously people are using for research, but you can also use them to do visualize them in interesting ways, which is something we're always, you know, ongoingly interested in.
And I just want to pick up, so you said that you're a painter, like that's your artistic background, and obviously you've still managed to, like, you're currently a researcher in cognitive neuroscience and you're definitely kind of continuing that scientific path. Have you managed to keep your art going?
So, you know what, I haven't really. I think the last time I sat down to paint properly was a couple of years ago in Spain, and that's not from a lack of interest, but I think sometimes people perceive art as a very cathartic and therapeutic, but it's also work. Painting, all kinds of art, it's hard work, and you need that headspace and that drive to do it.
And the inspiration, I suppose.
Of course, yeah. So I think at some point I've really started to feel like my work and what I want to put a lot of my time and efforts and education into is the neuroscience side. But art's always, you know, very important to me, and it's very important to me that I came from that artistic background. I think it forms a lot of how I think. So I would never say never for painting again, but okay, I need the headspace and a bigger room, probably a bigger flat to get some room for painting.
And you were telling me before the show, everyone's heard of kind of women in STEM, women in science, technology, education and maths. I can't remember what the E stands for. How terrible of me.
Engineering,
that's the one. It's like, it's definitely not education. And you said there's actually a new movement that's gathering a lot more interest, and that's STEAM.
Yes, STEAM. So it's STEM with art in the middle, nicely. So it's a lot about what I was talking before about having this rounded education of, you know, we should push people to, or not push people, but get women and everyone but involved in the sciences, but with the arts as well. They work so much better together, and as a way of accessing at an educational level, or just having that as part of your plethora of skills and understanding. And it's an especially important thing, I think, for young women to have those role models in science, and see it as something that is open to them and they can pursue.
If any of our listeners have been really interested in what you've been saying today, is there a way they can get involved?
Absolutely. We're always looking for people to be involved in terms of ideas for projects, or if they want to work on the curatorial side with us, that's great. So we have our website, which is axnscollective.org, or I think we'll be tweeting
that as well.
Yes. Just send us an email. Our email addresses are on the site, and also loads of our projects are on there, so you can get an idea of more things that we've done in the past.
Yeah, the Fractured Visions video is very good. I definitely recommend watching. Right, on to your fifth song, Rachel. What are we going with?
So my fifth song is, I think we've got, is it Chairlift?
Yes.
So I'm doing a lot of coding in my research at the moment, so I've really gotten into listening to synth pop at the same time. So this is one of the songs I've had on repeat over and over again, and it's Romeo by Chairlift. Hey, Romeo, put on your running shoes, I'm ready to go. Hey, Romeo, put on your running shoes, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go.
Science news. What did you bring with you as your science news this week?
So I wanted to talk about some research that's come out from the lab I'm currently doing my master's project in, which is on grid cells. So grid cells, we've known about them for about 10 years now. They're in the entorhinal cortex, which is near the hippocampus in the brain, which is heavily involved in our spatial memory. So grid cells are these cells that as we move around space, they fire periodically in this grid-like fashion, and it gives the brain a kind of internal coordinate system. So that's how we understand,
kind of like map coordinates.
Yes, so that's how we understand sort of where we are within space, and we use it to remember environments. So when we come back to them, we have an idea of where everything is. So these are largely looked at in rats, but we can also look at them in humans and look at how humans travel around virtual reality environments or virtual environments on a computer.
So do they make the grid cells fire as well?
Yes, yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Very helpful. So obviously there's problematic things about trying to record things while people are walking around in actual space. So if we can use these virtual environments, it's very useful. So some research that's come out recently by Dr. Aidan Horner and some other people within that lab is they found that these cells also fire when we imagine walking around space. So they've done this task in a virtual environment where you have to walk around an environment and memorize the location of objects. And then they record the fMRI signal, the bold signal, from when people move through the environment to retrieve them, or if they imagine moving within the environment to retrieve them. And they found the signal between these two things, this memory and this imagination, are very, very similar, almost identical. So that's a really interesting idea that grid cells are not only for us to remember our environment, but imagine our environment as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Mm. And that they can be triggered not by real environments, just by imagining virtual
So
ones.
By playing computer games, you're having this very similar experience in the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex as you would running around the place.
Wow.
Not the same exercise, I should add, though.
Producer Louise, what have you brought with you today?
Well, mine's also loosely based on the hippocampus. Whoop whoop, psych party up in here. So I found this really interesting article online about how we have... it's basically looking into neurons in the brain, and they've done an experiment with mice where they've discovered that that neurons can have positive and negative associations, and they found that by testing in the mice, they discovered that the mice were able to create these associations with the neurons, and what they think is that this might be able to be used for depression and schizophrenia, because if we can identify negative neurons in the brain, then maybe we can look into these and we can start seeing whether something can be done to make sure everyone's got a more positive outlook on life. So I think it sounds really interesting and exciting, and I'm definitely up for finding out more about it.
Yeah, so what they think, there's an actual kind of neural basis for negative thoughts being strengthened and having like an actual physical place in our brain.
Yeah, it's a really interesting study. We're going to tweet a link now just so everyone can read about it.
Yeah, fascinating.
As with many studies, I feel sorry for the rats in this case, especially.
Yeah, I know. It's always the rats, isn't it?
These poor rats.
My piece of science news is on a very different note. So I've gone spacey, and that's because on Monday, a new Mars mission will be launched from Kazakhstan. This is the ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter, and it is... Its main quest is to go to Mars and analyse some of the gas there, and they're hoping to look at the methane, which they think is very persistent, and if it's there, it could be like involved in microbial life. And what's quite interesting is, so this is a collaboration with the European Space Agency, and one of the professors, Professor Alvaro Jimenez, he said that actually... this is kind of like the main point of this mission, is not just to analyze the methane, but like proving that we have the technology to like land stuff on Mars.
We have the technology.
Yeah. If you want to be a partner in the future on more missions to Mars, you have to demonstrate your ability to land. If you can't, you are not at the right level. We have to show we can do it ourselves. I mean, I'm sure that's not an accurate description of his voice, but yeah. So I think for them, it's a big mission in terms of once the rocket gets to Mars, the little kind of it's called Schiaparelli, the sort of robot thing that will do all the analysis, has to be landed on the surface of Mars, and that's the kind of tricky part that they're hoping will go.
I've got a very important question. Do you think they'll let mice into Mars? Because all of our other experiments have been so focused around mice and rats.
Well, lots of the early tests of sending things into space were very much populated by
sending
animals.
Yeah, fair enough.
But how would they get the mice there over like 6 months? I don't know, you'd have to come up with some really clever contraptions for kind of like feeding them and cleaning them and making sure that, you know, they don't like overbreed and eat all their food in the first month.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So I think logistically,
mice.
Yeah.
I think they have done some interesting studies with mice in space looking at place cells that are related to grid cells. But I can't remember the outcome of it. But
maybe
yeah,
like if out of gravity your grid cells are like confused or something.
Poor out of gravity rats.
Oh. So there you go. Look out for the launch on Monday. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It's been so interesting.
Thank you. I've had fun.
And Lou, thank you so much for producing a fantastic show.
No worries. Had a great show.
Great having you. And what is our final song?
So our final song is an artist my mum really likes, and it's a song that means a lot to me as well. And it's also about an artist. So our final song is Don McLean, Vincent.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and grey. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land.